Thank you, Rabbi. And Shabbat Shalom, my friends. Thank you for letting me share some of my experiences that I had on a trip to Israel a few years ago. And it's a personal story, kind of my testimony, just me to you. But first, I want to offer a disclaimer. I believe that it would be absolutely wonderful if each and every one of you would be able to go to Israel to walk in the Holy Land. I mean, many times, as many times as you would like. You'd be blessed, as I have been blessed. But I want you to remember this. These are some words that Yeshua said to Thomas. This was Thomas after he insisted on seeing the scars that Yeshua had in his side and his hands. And Yeshua said to him, "You believe because you have seen, but blessed are those who believe who have not seen." So there it is, right there. Those of you who may not go or have not been, you're off the hook. Yeshua said that you are blessed. Even if you don't see Israel, you receive all that he has to bring you, and he blesses you. But here's how my story began. One day, seemingly out of the blue, our son said to us, "I'm going to go into the ministry." And normally that would not be unusual at all, except for one thing. Well, a few things. He was almost 40. He was married, and they were expecting their fifth child. And to do this, it would involve moving from where he worked to a place to go to seminary and potentially giving up his career. But being an Allen, he had a plan. But as it turns out, so did I. Now, I didn't really believe that he was going to receive a complete education at a seminary that he was going to need. So I invited him. He might say, I insisted that he come with me on a trip to Israel. See, I was a veteran. I'd been there with Lynn three times before, and I knew that this would be a great blessing to him. I knew what he was going to receive. This was a great way to start his ministry. And somehow, actually, he agreed. I was so excited for Chris because each time that I had gone, God had shown me, God had taught me something new, something I could bring back on each one of these trips. Things like, before I went, I thought the Bible was about stuff that was long ago and far away. But think about this. You get on a plane in New York. 10 years later, you're... 10 hours. I'll get it right. 10 hours later, you're in Tel Aviv, okay? If you get in a car and you drive to Atlanta, it's 10 hours. So suddenly, the other side of the world didn't feel like it was that far away. And then as an architect, I had studied societies and so forth that contributed to architectures like the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans. And I'd learn about their cultures and the influence they had on us. And it dawned on me when I was there that all of that had occurred before Yeshua walked on the earth. I mean, the Romans were still there, but everything else had come before. So all these ancient things I was studying were old. Yeshua wasn't really that old. He lived during all those times. Also, I learned that the Bible's real. I mean, you know, you walk around there and you see Nazareth and Bethlehem, Jerusalem. You go to Capernaum, Cana. You go to all these places that are mentioned in the Bible. They're real, and they're still there. Interestingly enough, we have a book at home that has 123 lithographs, drawings, and paintings by a man named Roberts, David Roberts, who visited Israel, the Holy Land, in 1839. And he recorded what it looked like then. And it's fascinating because all these sites that we visit are there, but they're pretty simple, pretty small, pretty ancient kind of thing. And outside of them, it's just all desert, all wilderness. It's rocks and sand and occasional Roman columns sticking up and ruins, you know, that are popping up through the sand, which is an interesting juxtaposition. But it's not modern. In 1839, we were a fairly modern country already. Think about Europe. All these cathedrals got built in the 1500s, 1600s, they were all there. I mean, this was there. None of that was in his lithographs. This was an ancient, almost forgotten place. The people that he depicted there were the Turks. They ran the place for years and years and years, hundreds of years. And they were the guides for those like Roberts, who was a pilgrim there coming to the Holy Land. The only other people that show up in his drawings are the Bedouins. They had the tents that they would live in, and they were the ones that tended all the sheep. And they're still there today. You can see them out in the mountains. And yeah, it is true that Yeshua walked on dusty roads. You know, and there's scriptures that talk about shaking the dust off your feet. There's scriptures that talk about washing your feet, because a lot of the roads were dusty. But what I hadn't realized was that he also walked on streets of marble. Jerusalem was unbelievable. Herod the Great was a prolific builder, and he had rebuilt the temple in 20 BC to something that was proclaimed to be one of the greatest wonders of the ancient world. This was spectacular. So not only were the dusty streets part of Yeshua's world, but so was the modern city and all of the people there. And we're talking about the time when Rome had a government, they had senators, they had all this stuff, and they were sophisticated people. And he was among those people, not just a bunch of country bumpkins that we might think might have been back there. So my point here is that we don't have to change the Bible to be updated because we have computers and sent a man to the moon. The things we deal with in our lives are virtually the same thing that people were dealing with in their lives in Yeshua's day. The Bible is relevant. And then when you come back home, of course, you read the Bible, you pick it up, and you picture everything you saw. You read about a place, you remember it, you read about a situation, you know where it's at. One of the fun ones is Jerusalem. It's always referred to as going up to Jerusalem. And it is high. It's 2,500 feet up. It's kind of on the top of a mountaintop. There's some others around it. So it doesn't seem too strange. But when you think about it, the Dead Sea is minus 1,350 feet. It's that far below sea level. It's the lowest place on the earth. Now, compare to that, in the United States, we have Death Valley, the lowest place in the United States. And it's 280 feet below sea level. So 280 feet below sea level versus 1,350 feet below sea level. Death Valley isn't even in the conversation. In fact, what's fascinating, and most people didn't realize, I didn't remember, no, was that the Galilee itself, the Galilee Lake River, Jordan River, it's 650 feet below sea level. So here's sea level, here's the Jordan Valley. Why isn't it full of water? I don't know. You figure that out. But here's the fun part. You drive from the Dead Sea, and you're in your bus, and it's going around the turns and everything, climbing the mountain. The engine's churning and everything, and you're climbing, and you're looking down the valley below, and then you see this sign, and your brain does not compute. And then you say, nah, this is a joke, because the sign says sea level. And you're in the mountains, and you look down, and you can see these valleys below, and it's the sea level. But it's real. That's where sea level is. You'll never forget it once you experience it. Also learned that certain places that Yeshua mentions or other people mention are actual places. Now, when he was with his disciples up at Caesarea Philippi, and they're talking about, you know, he's talking about, you know, who do they say I am and so forth. And one of the comments he makes is, he says, the gates of hell will not prevail against the kingdom of God. Well, when you go there, when you go to Mount Hermon, when you are at Caesarea Philippi, there's this spooky cave. This place where once a year water would come spewing out of it as the snow would melt off of Mount Hermon, and all the ancient peoples knew that the underworld gods were blessing them one more year with this water. So they put these statues of Pan and all these other underworld gods there. And I tell you, it's an awful place. But what's it called? The gates of hell. So I was wondering what God was going to teach me this time. It's a new trip. New learning. But I remembered that this time, this was about Chris. This was about my son. What he would learn. I was just going to be a guide. I was going to be a facilitator. There would be absolutely nothing for me to learn that would be new, and I was fine with that. Boy, was I wrong. So typically, you know what it's like. We're scrambling around to do this. You know, he had just said it, and I said, well, let's go. And we found a Zola Levitt trip that was going to go, and it was only in a few weeks, and miraculous, they had a couple spots, and we got the spots. Then we had to get the connecting flights. I'm coming up from Florida, going up to Indiana to meet with him, and we're flying up to New York. It was just crazy. Packing, doing all this stuff. Passports. Remember passports. Arranging for Grandma Lynn to be able to come up and help out with the grandchildren while we're gone. Everything was scramble, rush, hurry. And those of you who have been on a trip to Israel know that it's really not any different than going to any other foreign country, except for one thing, incredibly tight security. And thank God for that. Now, of course, you're flying out of New York, so there's TSA. You go through that, it's normal, no big deal. And then you enter a room, and there's these dudes in there, these serious dudes. I mean, they're like Mossad. I mean, think Navy SEALs. And you're going to get interviewed by them. Oh, boy. So my honest son gets called up by one of these guys. Yeah. Okay, Mr. Allen, is this your suitcase? He says, no. What do you mean? Well, my father loaned it to me. Okay. Well, Mr. Allen, is everything in your suitcase yours? He says, no. What do you mean, no? Well, half of it's my father's and half of it's mine, and I put half of my stuff in his suitcase. And this guy's like, where's your father? So I go up and everything gets solved. But it's not so much the questions. We hear those questions all the time, but it's the profiling. I mean, you know that they are looking at you for every nuance, every expression, every body language, everything. They've got you pegged. You know, in this country, we say, well, we don't profile. That's a horrible thing. Well, they've taken it to an art. And justifiably so. In 1972, there was a plane that flew from Tel Aviv, and it made a stop in Athens. And some terrorists got on, and they hijacked it, and they took it to a place that nobody had ever heard of. It was called Entebbe in Africa. And if you want to hear about an incredible story of redemption, go to YouTube, type in Entebbe, and you will see what happens. It's good news. Bottom line, no more hijackings of any Israeli planes. And then, of course, there's the Orthodox. If, except for, say, Brooklyn, there's more Orthodox on a 747 going from New York to Tel Aviv than any other place in the world. They're just there. It's like half the flight. Yeah, they got their black on. They've got the hats. They've got the payas. They look wonderful. Then their wives are there with their wigs. The little kids are all dressed up. The little boys have more payas. It's just fun. It's fun. And then you wake up in the middle of the night and you realize some of them opened the windows on the plane. And why? Because we're approaching the rising sun and they're there davening their morning prayers. And you realize that the cultural shift is in full bloom. When you get off the plane, though, now, there's this beautiful terminal. I mean, it looks American. I mean, it is so slick, beautiful, just wonderful place. With one exception, the signs. The signs are written in Hebrew, in Arabic, and in English, everywhere. That's the only clue that you're not at home anymore. You find those signs on all the roads, too. Same thing, three languages. So you know the drill. You get there, you do your customs, you find your bus. It's just 10 hours of tranquility in the air is suddenly bursted by a bunch of rushing around again. You sit back and relax in the bus, and you're driving along, and you might as well be in Florida. You're going along the seacoast. You've got beaches, palm trees, shiny white condos. It's absolutely gorgeous. And I'm thinking to myself, am I really here? But then you come upon the Roman ruins at Caesarea. They have found so much there. There's this huge Roman theater. I mean, there's nothing like that in the USA, I can guarantee you. And you enjoy this so much. And I remember saying to my son, we are here. Onto the Sea of Galilee, you board an old-fashioned looking boat. And unlike the storms that were talked about in the scriptures, you go out into into this lake, smooth, tranquil. They turn off the engine. It's quiet. You begin singing worship songs. And you remember, as I mentioned in the scripture, Yeshua walked on these waters. Well, Chris and I both said to each other, he was here, right here. Now, the Galilee is so beautiful. It's just gorgeous with this wonderful lake. I don't know how it got called a sea. It's a wonderful lake. But anyway, it's a sea. They call that pond in front of our house a lake, too. So everybody, who knows? But Chris and I would get up for devotions in the morning. We would walk down to the waterfront. We'd watch the sunrise. And we would sit there in this kibbutz and just enjoy it. And I thought many times, I could live in the Galilee. But then, there is Jerusalem. No other place in the world like it. As you approach it, as you begin to have your first glimpses, I mean, it can literally take your breath away when you see it. And it seems like it's always been that way. Isaiah in 52:1 says, "Awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion. Put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city." It's called the City of Gold. There's songs written about it. And why? Well, it's built out of Jerusalem stone, which is a kind of a whitish, creamy sandstone that has this terrific property that during a sunrise, it appears to turn to gold. And during a sunset, it appears to turn to gold, these stones. And there's only a few places I know of in the world where an architectural law has done such a good thing. In 1918, the Jerusalem Council, that's 100 years ago, they said all buildings, new, every remodel, all that, had to be Jerusalem stone. So if you approach it and you don't know, you don't recognize, you just know that this is a beautiful city with the monolithic color, with this wonderful thing, old, new, all blended together, all tied together with this one building material. The only thing we have in this country that I can think of is like the Keys. You go down to the Keys, it's a whole different feeling down there. Why? Because they restrict the buildings when it's outside a municipality, only 35 feet, 40 now, they've changed it. But you drive through there, and you can see the water. You can appreciate the place. It's not like Miami Beach, with along A1A with this wall of condos. It's not like that at all. And it's an absolutely beautiful feeling. Another place, the only other one that I know of, is Santa Fe, New Mexico. Back a long, long time ago, someone decreed that it had to be built out of adobe. Now, adobe is available all throughout the Southwest, but they chose in this one city to build this one city 100% out of adobe. So when you come there, you know you're in a different place and you experience this. And so it is with Jerusalem. Fun part of Jerusalem is entering the old city. You're in there, there's endless walkways, alleyways, shops. It's wonderful. There's the sights, the sounds, the smells that I mentioned. There's food. Every other shop is food. You can be walking along just eating your falafel. It's just absolutely fantastic. Or there's little courtyards in various places, and people set out tables, and you can just sit down and enjoy it. There are Israeli vendors. There's Arab vendors. And yes, there's different quarters where they generally are, but they intermingle, and they all work together, live together pretty much in peace. And finally, you emerge upon the Western Wall, and all that noise, all that activity just ends. This plaza in front of the Western Wall is strangely quiet. There can be hundreds of people there, and yet it's just quiet, unless someone's blowing a shofar, which doesn't really break the silence that much. And it's a beautiful, beautiful place. It's powerful. And you look at these stones, and the ones with the edging around it are called Herodian stones. Herod built those stones. Most of them are lower. Back before Yeshua was born, those stones were laid. And you can walk up and you can actually touch a wall that Jewish people couldn't approach for 1900 years. From 70 AD, when they were thrown out of Jerusalem, till 1967, this was all restricted. Now you can go up, touch that wall, sit there and look at people from all around the world with their little pieces of paper where they have their scribbled prayers. They fold it up and they stick it in the cracks of the wall because they want their prayers to be as close as possible to where God placed his name. It's a powerful place. And as I stood there at that wall, I was thinking to myself, it's not I am here. It's not even that Yeshua was here. What I was looking for all this time is, here I am. The word is Hineni. It's the servant's cry. It means behold me. It's used throughout the scripture and made famous by Isaiah. In 6:8, it says, God speaking, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And Isaiah answers, here I am. Here am I. Hineni, send me. But it's also spoken by Abraham, Hineni, Joseph, Hineni, Moses, Hineni, Samuel, Hineni. Interestingly enough, God said it. In Isaiah 58:9, it says, you shall cry and the Lord will answer. You shall cry out and he will say, here am I, Hineni. Then in Revelation 3:20, Yeshua says, behold, Hineni, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and eat, and he with me. And I realize this is a very powerful word. So my quest for an answer of was God going to give me something on this trip was finally clear to me. I was both excited and at peace, grateful for God's blessing of giving me this. And now I could just relax, enjoy the trip, have fun with Chris. Or so I thought. We found ourselves at Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. Interesting that we're talking about this on this particular day. Now, I'd never been to this museum before. The trips I'd been on just didn't have it on their itinerary. I mean, I'm not a Holocaust denier or a diminisher. I wouldn't have avoided going there. I wanted to go there. I've seen the traveling displays, the documentaries, the movies, Schindler's List, The Pianist, the book, I've read it, called Night by Elie Wiesel. But this place, I was not prepared for. To start, you enter an area called the Court of the Righteous Gentiles. And I thought, how cool. I mean, there's Oscar Schindler's name by a tree, and Corey Ten Boom's name by a tree, and there's all these other people's names by these trees. A lot of them I didn't recognize. Shame on me. And I thought, this is really great. And it was like, the minute I said that, I thought, this is terrible. Why is this just a grove of trees? Why isn't it a forest? Where were we? Where were we? So I was more shaken by this experience than I thought I would be. And as I approached the main building, my architect in me kicked in, and I'd been fascinated to see this building, and I really, really wanted to enjoy it, and I really almost forgot why I was there. See, the building is like a triangle. There's a floor, and the walls are tilted in, and it's in the form of a shaft. And at the top of the shaft, where it doesn't touch, there's a skylight that runs continuously. And this shaft is thrust through the top of a mountain. And the tail end of it sticks out away from the mountain. Then it goes through the mountain. And after it passes through the mountain, it shatters. The walls peel up. The floor goes out. It's an incredible piece of architecture, and I was fascinated to be there. And in order to get into it, you go up a bridge, because it's up in the air. It's out in space. Cantilevered out there. You go through these glass doors. And the first thing I saw, you would see, is there's this huge movie screen on the side of the wall. And it's I didn't understand what it was, because it was like a parade, except the camera's moving. So it's like you're sitting there moving in a parade, and these people are going by, and there's all these people. And they're standing there all dressed up, and in front there's all these little kids, these beautiful little children. They're just standing there. And they all were dressed to the hilt, and they had little flags in their hands. And it wasn't like what you see at a 4th of July parade where people are excited. They were kind of pensive. They were just sort of, you know. And as I looked at it, I realized there were swastikas on these little flags that these kids were waving. And I thought, who are they? And instantly I remembered where I was. And suddenly I knew who they were and where they were going. And it's like my knees just didn't want to hold me up. So I turn and I look down this shaft building. There's a railroad track running right down the center. There's a car, a box car, probably a real one, that would have transported Jewish people to the camps. And there's this sound. No sirens or anything, but just the sounds of the trains constantly, the wheels clanking, the brakes squealing, all of this. And it's just continuous throughout this entire experience. And there's rooms cut into the side of the mountain. So it's not just the shaft. There's this big room over here and another big room over here and another big room over here, all hidden from the outside. You don't see any of this. And you go through each of these exhibits, and I slowly made my way through, looking at the awful but familiar sights of the Holocaust. But I learned a few new things that day. I learned that there weren't just the few death camps we talk about. There were 37 death camps. And they weren't just in Germany and Poland. They were all over the place. There were 9 additional countries in Europe that had these death camps. It wasn't safe for Jews anywhere. Anywhere where the Russians were occupying or had a treaty. I mean, remember, Anne Frank was in Amsterdam. Amsterdam. And then stunningly, I learned that after the liberation, many prisoners had nowhere to go. Remember, their houses had been confiscated, and people were living there. And these folks weren't gone for a few weeks. They were gone for up to a few years. People had taken over their place, and they were no longer welcome there. So unless they had a relative or somebody that they could go to, they actually had to return to the very camps that they'd been liberated from until they could find a place to live. Can you imagine that? But then my eyes were drawn to a black and white television and a man speaking in Hebrew. And the sign said that these were the testimonies of Holocaust survivors, recorded to preserve their history before they had all passed away. Now, this particular man was old. He looked stout. He looked like he was a strong man. But he was crying, just bawling, and was having trouble speaking. And I stood there and I read the translation, and I couldn't believe what I was reading. He said that every day the prisoners were rounded up and gathered into a yard between the buildings for some kind of a muster. And he said that every day someone was shot and killed. And he said that he and his buddies saw that it was always the people on the perimeter, people in the front and on the outer edge, they were the ones that were getting shot and killed. And many of these were weak, sick, frail. They maybe couldn't make it into the inside. They were maybe late getting to whatever it was. So he and his friends began every day to push their way into the center so they could just be in the middle of this mass. And that way they ensured their survival. But now, a lifetime from all of this, he was beyond remorseful. He was a broken person because he knew what he and his friends had done. He knew that when they had preserved their lives, that every day they had condemned someone else. Now, I was deeply saddened by this, and I have to admit, a little angry Why hadn't they manned up? Why hadn't they formed a perimeter to save those who couldn't save themselves? And man, oh man, oh man. At that very moment, it was like God was not going to let me get away with that one. He reminded me that all of my life, I have spent every effort to protect and save the people that I love, keep them safe. And all the while, ignoring those who are outside of my group. And I had no answer. There was nothing I could say in my defense. So I could now see why God had brought me to this museum, this place. And as I managed to make it towards the exit, glass wall, glass doors, walked outside, the doors closed behind me, and mercifully, all that sound stopped. And I hadn't realized how utterly annoying that it had been. Now it was just peace and quiet. And now the building, these walls that went up, they were like upstretched hands reaching up to God. And I began to understand what the architect had done. I walked out to the end of the floor, hanging out in space over another valley with nothing but a glass railing around. And I walked up there, and it was serene. It was beautiful. There was no civilization down there, just beautiful trees and birds flying. You could hear, that was the only sound you heard, was them chirping. Sometimes they were flying below you. We were up so high, it was kind of bizarre. But it was wonderful. And I stood there crying out to God. I just had one big question. Why them? Why them? They were the same as me, all of these people. They were ordinary people leading ordinary lives. Some of them might have been professionals, some teachers, some shopkeepers, some workers, some musicians. You know, they were just like us, just like us. Just like us. But my question then changed. Why me? Why has my life been so different? Why has my life been so blessed? And survivor's remorse just enveloped me. And as I stood there, another word came to me, and it was out of nowhere, so strange, so completely out of context. It was the word Dainu. Dainu? From Passover? Really? And it occurred to me that I, maybe all of us, had lived our lives always seeking one more blessing, and not always saying to God, it is sufficient for the previous blessing. And I thought, maybe I, maybe us, maybe we're not so good at being content with what we have, what God has given us, what he's already done for us. And I'm not saying that we live our lives without gratitude. I know that we do, and that we appreciate God. But we do tend to ask for one more blessing. So I spent the rest of the trip, and actually the rest of my life since then, it's been 19 years, contemplating these two words, Hineni and Dainu, and how to apply them to my life. Now the word Hineni is almost always preceded with the calling of one's name, usually doubled. It's like Abraham, Abraham. He says, Moses, Moses, John, John. It's personal. And our answer is personal. Behold me. Here am I. And the word Dainu is associated with celebration, feelings of well-being. I mean, isn't Passover one of our happiest times of the year? But by saying Dayenu there and singing about it, we're acknowledging our dependence on God, that he did this even if he didn't do this, and then he did that even if he didn't do this other thing. And we recognize the importance of that. So I believe that these were two words that were important to remember, two words to live by, two words to teach our children. But now before I close today, I really want to address the elephant in the room. It's already been mentioned once today, maybe twice. October 7th in Israel, a new day of infamy. Now, President Roosevelt used that word, a day of infamy, when he described the bombing of Pearl Harbor. But I believe it fits. It is a day of infamy. It's a day when Israel changed. It's a day when the world changed. Now, I'm an old man. I was born in the middle of the Holocaust. I was 5 years old when the new state of Israel was founded. And as far back as I can remember, I was taught and I believed in the words, never again. And I believed in the hope. I think it was fascinating that Harvey put that up there, HaTikvah, the national anthem of Israel, the hope. And I never believed that the Holocaust in any form could ever be repeated. The world had moved on. Today's world was better than that. On October 7th, we learned otherwise. And most shocking to me, and probably to you, was that many in the world sided against Israel. And an ugly, deeply hidden truth, the truth of anti-Semitism, was revealed like I've never seen it in my life. It's really out there. There's people who support the Jews in Israel. There's people who are now openly not. Now, all of you, our congregation, our covering organization, in fact, all of Messianic Judaism, fully supports Israel in every way. And that's important. That's great. And we need to continue that. But we also need to remember who we are. It was Martin Luther King Jr. who said, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can drive out darkness. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can drive out hate." Now, as believers, we're called to love God with all of our heart and to love our neighbors as ourselves. And Yeshua, uncomfortably in the parable of the Good Samaritan, reminds us that our neighbor isn't just those of us here. At a time like this, we want to take action. We want to do something. And it's hard to remember Ephesians 6, but it's certainly important to remember. We war not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers of darkness. Goes on to say, so take up the full armor of God and stand. Stand. That's what he requires of us. And I believe that it is time to take our eyes off the things of the world, off of the horrible images that stir up our emotions. And I'm not advocating that we turn our backs on Israel, not at all. I just think we need to be not obsessed with the horror. That's what terrorists want. They want us to be terrorized. Let us not be terrorized. Let us turn our eyes instead to God with all of our belief, all of our hope, crying out to him. And maybe our cry would include, "Hineni, here am I, God, and Dayenu. God, you have been and you are sufficient always for me." Amen. Amen. Amen.